This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, more than 400 people gathered at a special memorial mass in Houston to remember 19 men, women, and children who died in and around a trailer last Wednesday in South Texas. They were illegal immigrants, packed for transport, and when the driver realized that many were dead and dying, abandoned on the side of the road. Since then, other smuggling incidents have been reported. 17 suspected illegal immigrants were discovered in a railroad container car near the Texas-New Mexico border last Thursday. All of them were alive. On Friday, authorities found 10 more illegals who'd not had any food or water for 2 days, hiding under a sheet of plywood in a pickup truck in a Houston suburb. The U.S. Border Patrol arrests about 1 million illegal immigrants every year. More than 90% are Mexican. As borders tighten, crossing the border becomes more difficult. Many illegals pay men known as coyotes to smuggle them across. In hot weather, the trip can turn deadly. Later this hour, the United States has surprised many by announcing its agreement to the International Tobacco Treaty, plus our weekly letters segment. But first, illegal immigration. Are you concerned about border safety? Do borders have to be tighter, or do you worry that U.S. immigration policies put people at risk? We'd especially like to hear from you if you live or work near the border. Our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. NPR's John Burnett reports regularly on border issues. He joins us now from Houston, Texas. And John, always good to have you on the program.
Thanks, Neil. Great to be here.
Is there something unusual about this cluster of discoveries over the past several days?
Well, it is odd that there have been so many of these incidents, starting with this tragic one down in Victoria, Texas, southwest of here last week. Usually these kinds of things are spread out all summer long. It is not unusual that when the temperatures start to climb, these tragedies start to be discovered. Usually you find most of the deaths still occurring in the desert, not in boxcars and not in these big 18-wheelers. If you look at the numbers at the end of the dangerous season, which is probably up until September or October in the Southwest, you do find more deaths in the desert from exposure, particularly in Arizona, up north of Naco and Douglas, Arizona. But I guess people are asking, why this cluster? Are there larger numbers coming through in these hazardous means? And then the next question is, why is that happening? I mean, you said in the lead that it is harder to cross, and so immigrants are having to use smugglers more than they used to, and by its nature, that's going to put them at risk. And the smugglers are making more money all the time, and so they're putting more immigrants together in these larger groups. Perhaps it's too early to see any trends. It's something certainly a lot of people are watching.
The man who was driving this trailer truck with these particular load of immigrants in South Texas says he was paid, a couple of $1,000 to deliver them. Do authorities believe he was responsible for all this, or is he part of a larger operation?
They're saying this was Tyrone Williams, the 32-year-old from Schenectady, New York, who was arrested last week, hours after the Victoria County Sheriff's Department made this macabre discovery inside that 18-wheeler. 17 dead, 2 died later. Thankfully, 49 survivors. I should tell you the news today is that here in Houston, the word is there have been more arrests in that case, which would lead us to believe it certainly was a larger organization, and we should find out later today. We know that there were at least 2 other individuals they were looking for. And in part, it's because we understand that the 49 surviving immigrants that were taken into the community center down in Victoria and given water and food and clothes agreed to cooperate with investigators. And a lot of times they're terrified because they're afraid they'll all be deported. But Eduardo Ibarola, the Mexican consul here in Houston, apparently spoke with him and said, you've got to help the U.S. authorities catch these people. And so the investigation is moving forward pretty well from what we hear.
Now, you mentioned that it seemed to be unusual, at least in the past, for these 18-wheelers to be used for smuggling.
Well, it is. I mean, I've been covering off and on the border for 15 years and intensively for the past 3 years, and you typically see smaller vehicles, vans and trucks, and even, you know, cars with their trunks, and typically they would stop short of a Border Patrol checkpoint, and everyone would hop out, and they would trot around the desert a few miles beyond the checkpoint, and then the car would go through and pick them up again. They continue north. But this trend of using these 18-wheelers seems to be something really in the last couple of years, and investigators have said that they're seeing it more and more. And obviously, they're extraordinarily dangerous, because once you close the doors on those things, you can't open them from the inside. And there have been numerous cases where immigrants have suffocated in these rolling ovens mm-hmm. once the sun comes out.
Well, it suggests that this is being done on an industrial scale, almost.
That's right, because the profits are breathtaking on this, and it's a direct result of in the last really 6, 7, 8 years, when the U.S. immigration has cracked down on illegal immigration all along the southwest border. It's made it so difficult to go across casually, to use cousins or friends. Now more and more immigrants are using professional smugglers, and the smugglers are, you know, have doubled their prices to go north to places like Phoenix and Houston and Dallas, and so they can really rake it in now. And I think it becomes, as you said, a larger scale business, and that much more ruthless.
In the old days, if a TV network was doing an expose about the Mexican border, they would always shoot film of somebody swimming across the Rio Grande into Brownsville or something like that. What you're saying is that's not done anymore?
No, it is. It is still done, but not into Brownsville proper, because part of this Southwest strategy by the U.S. immigration has been in the urban centers along the border. So it's had the effect of driving the immigrants into rural areas. There certainly is still swimming the river going on, and there's still drownings. But it seems to be more organized, you know, more groups than just individuals coming across and kind of bushwhacking north.
Well, John, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Neil.
And NPR's John Burnett reports regularly on border issues. He's with us by phone from Houston, Texas. Professor David Spiener joins us now. He's an associate professor of sociology at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He specializes in coyotes. He joins us from his office in San Antonio. And thanks for being with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
For those who may not be familiar with the term, tell us what a coyote is.
Well, a coyote is somebody who is a paid guide to help people get across the U.S.-Mexico border and get on to their destination further in the interior of the United States. Coyote is not the only name given to these kinds of guides. It's the most common one, and it connotes, if you think about the kind of folk tales as well as the popular TV program Wile E. Coyote, the idea is it's somebody who is perhaps not fully trustworthy, but somebody who is clever and stealthy and can get you across the border and escape detection by the authorities in the process. But there are other names that these guides go by. Also, they're known as polleros on other parts of the border because the migrants being moved are known as pollos, and hence the person moving them is the pollero. And in South Texas, where we're talking about a river crossing, the term of art in northeast Mexico, I should say, is patero, because the word Spanish word for duck being led across the river, is a pato, and hence the person bringing them across is the patero.
And if my Spanish is good, which it isn't, but pollo would be chicken?
Pollo is chicken, exactly.
Yes, right. How big a business is this?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very big business, but I think it's a very big business composed of lots of small operators, for the most part. And I think that it is certainly tragic what has occurred with the 18-wheeler tractor trailers in recent years. This has been going on, actually, since at least the 1970s, and if you go back and look in the journalistic record from back then, you'll find cases like these coming through this region. And it's not necessarily the case, I think, that the people who are responsible for moving people in these 18-wheelers are necessarily large-scale very sophisticated kinds of organizations, that you could still manage to pull something like this off, at least occasionally, with a relatively small number of people, say 5 to 10 people working together in Mexico and in the United States.
How much does it cost? What's the price to be smuggled across the U.S. border?
Well, it varies. I mean, one of the tragic ironies, I think, about this case is that being moved in a tractor trailer like this, especially one where it's being advertised on the Mexican side as being air conditioned, you pay more. And I think that's one of the reasons why we saw a fairly large proportion of the passengers consisting of women, as well as at least one young child. And I think there was also an elderly man who was aboard as well. And the idea here is that you pay more to make a trip like this because you're not going to spend perhaps 4, 5, 6 days walking through the brush in the summer weather. Instead, you're going to spend 4 or 5 hours, presumably in air-conditioned conditions. Apparently, on the Mexican side, the press has been saying that survivors have said they had been told to wear sweaters and jackets while they were in this car in order to not be cold. And so they paid, I've been hearing, I don't have details of this case other than what I've been reading in the press, but they paid supposedly $1,800. You can pay as little as $800 or $1,000, depending on the quality of the service. I heard John Burnett saying, you know, that typically what will happen is people will end up marching through the brush for a long period of time, or perhaps hopping a freight car. And in those cases, you would pay less. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's important to realize is, and this is often misquoted in the press, is that people typically do not pay the full amount up front, and actually in many cases don't pay very much of the fee up front, but rather it's collected sort of COD once people arrive in a place like Houston and go to an apartment or house there where they're going to wait until relatives or friends come to pay off their smuggling fee. This, of course, makes it much more possible for relatively impoverished Mexicans to make the trip in the first place. They don't have to get together that amount of money up front.
Well, let's get some listeners involved. 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. And Kevin joins us on the line from Denver.
Hi, yes. My question is, I wonder if any, what effect the NAFTA has on the increased use of tractor trailers for smuggling illegal immigrants.
Professor Spiener, a lot more traffic.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's happened with NAFTA is greatly increased the cross-border traffic of tractor trailers. And one of the problems that I think the United States faces in terms of its policies is, you know, there are histories of countries that have greatly curtailed the movement of people across their borders and effectively done so. Checkpoint Charlie was still with us as recently as the late 1980s between the two Berlins. But we don't have much of a history of countries that trade as much as Mexico and the United States do, really trying to control movement across the borders as strictly as the United States at least would like to. And so, yes, I mean, one of the things that we're seeing is, I was just looking at the figures in an article here published in our San Antonio Express News that say in the McAllen-Hidalgo International Bridge, this is just one bridge, in the month of December, 700,000 vehicles came across. Not all of them were trucks, but a very large number of them were. And at this point, at least, it has not been possible for border inspectors to inspect more than a very small percentage of all those tractor trailers coming through. It would just back things up too much.
Just a few seconds left before we have to go, but any idea whether the traffic has gone up or down in the past couple of years?
Well, I mean, I think it's gotten considerably more difficult to come across the border. But the thing that we have to remember, at least in the Texas stretch of the border, is that it's always been difficult to get out of South Texas. Getting across the border, as John Burnett mentioned a few moments ago, is not all that difficult. The difficulty is getting yourself out of a place like Brownsville or Harlingen or McAllen or Mission and getting on to where you really want to go to work.
David Spiener, we've got to go, but thank you so much. David Spiener with the Trinity University in San Antonio. More after a break. It's Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about undocumented migrants and the dangers of crossing the border from Mexico into the United States and then moving on to the job markets of Texas and Oklahoma and Arizona. How are tighter borders affecting illegal immigration? If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Douglas Massey joins us now, a professor of sociology, director of the Mexican Migration Project at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the author of Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, Mexican Immigration in an Era of Economic Integration. He's with us from his office in Philadelphia, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Texas is not the only place where immigrants take a lot of risks to get into the U.S. Last Thursday, a group of Cuban migrants surrendered to the U.S. Coast Guard after jumping into the Gulf of Mexico, treading water in an attempt to elude capture. What other problems are you seeing around the country?
Well, the two main ports of undocumented entry are the Caribbean and the Mexico-U.S. border. And in the Caribbean, it's Haitians, Dominicans, and Cubans are the leading ones. And in the Mexico-U.S. border, it's, of course, Mexicans plus Central Americans who travel through Mexico on their way northward.
How are changes in border policy affecting illegal or illegal migration patterns?
Well, for both of them, it's had the paradoxical effect of increasing lengths of stay in the United States. The what happens when you militarize the border and make it very costly and dangerous to come into the United States is you don't discourage people from coming so much as discourage them from going home once they're here. Once they've paid the upfront costs, once they've paid the higher prices, they have to work longer to pay off their overhead payment for getting in, and they're reluctant to face the gauntlet at the border again, so they stay longer. As they stay longer, they put down roots and send for wives and children. So the militarization of the border has really had the effect of transforming what was a circular movement of males into a settled population of men with dependent wives and children. Hmm. And it's really promoted a settlement in a much more marginal status.
Let's get another caller involved. Tom joins us now from San Diego, right on the border.
Yes, right. I'm along the border, and during the evening, I see the floodlights come on from the helicopters occasionally, and they're chasing somebody. And I know that hundreds are getting through. And I asked a border agent, I said, well, about how many are you catching? I says, half. And they said, oh, are you kidding? Maybe 1%. And I says, well, then how long do you keep them? And they says, well, they'll be back the next day. And I said, well, this is a revolving door that just enters in the U.S. Now, I had a rare opportunity to talk to somebody like chairman of a major food corporation, and my understanding is that there's a real interest of America, a corporate interest, of having the population of the United States increase because it increases retail sales of all products in this country, and it's incredibly important, apparently, to these billionaires. And what's happening is I ask the people coming in, I ask the Mexicans who are coming in, and I say, well, what is the problem there? And they say, well, we don't have money. And I says, but how many children do you have? And they say, well, 5, 7, 8 children. And the family sizes are quite large, and they come here, and they're paid to have children. I believe the whole game is a population replacement game, and it's quite serious, and it's much more than what we're being told. We're being given cover stories that are very unreal about poverty, and it's about population growth and aggression, and it's aggression by the billionaires, it's aggression by the poor people. Mm-hmm. It's not a sane world we're in.
Douglas Massey, get a response from you?
Well, I don't agree with a lot of the facts. First of all, the fertility rate in Mexico is now about 2.3 children per woman, so it's very unusual to find Mexican women with 5, 6, 7 children. That's really a thing of the past. Second of all, we have a free trade agreement with Mexico that, you know, is designed by treaty to promote the cross-border movements of goods and capital and information and products of all sorts. When you integrate an economy, you're also going to have labor moving. And the more you try to prevent the movement of labor, the kind of worse you make it for yourself and for your trading partners. So the fact that Mexicans are coming to the United States is nothing new. It's nothing surprising. They're not people fleeing desperate poverty so much as trying to migrate and use a period of labor in the United States to solve some kind of economic problem at home. And if left to their own devices, most of the people will return home. The militarization of the borders made it harder for Mexicans to go back and promoted their settlement in the U.S. So we've kind of messed up a an ongoing process that's been unfolding over the past 50 years.
Email question from Linda Pritchard in Vancouver, Washington. Why does our administration not pressure President Fox to improve conditions in Mexico so that people can manage to support themselves there, perhaps even offer concrete help to improve things there? Then the Mexican people won't have to make that desperate decision to risk their lives to come here.
Well, President Fox doesn't need to be pressured. He's working very hard to improve conditions in Mexico. The second part of the suggestion, why doesn't the U.S. do more to help Mexico, I think is legitimate. When poor countries like Spain and Portugal entered the European Union, they were given generous subsidies to help them build their markets, to solve some of the economic problems they had, to create a minimal social safety net, so that when they finally entered the European Union, the incentives for migration simply weren't there.
But wasn't that some of the idea of NAFTA, to help Mexico improve its economy so that there would be jobs there?
Yes, but we didn't quite go the full mile. We opened the border to trade, but then we didn't provide any of the development assistance that went along with the European Union's accession policy for poorer countries like Spain and Portugal and now Poland. So we really provided very little, if any, assistance to Mexico to solve some of the market problems. I mean, Americans have kind of a skewed vision of Mexico as this desperately poor place. Mexico is actually a fairly rich place. It's what I like to call the first world of the third world. It's got a fairly high per capita income, and it's only because it shares a border with the United States that it appears to be very poor. But it's a rapidly developing country. It's had its problems and setbacks over the years, but developing a market economy is not an easy process.
Let's go to Sam, and Sam's on the line from Rock Springs in Wyoming.
Yeah, as an educational proposition, there's a collateral image problem, and that is that it may well be a situation where a lot of these people who are coming in from Mexico have been advised that certain areas of this country are safe havens, because no matter what you do as far as the criminal law is concerned, the INS is not going to pick you up, and that can create real problems.
Well, the U.S. Congress has really increased penalties for criminal activity, and I've worked with migrant populations for 20 years, and I certainly don't. I've never heard of anything like a safe haven and a belief that you could come here and commit crimes. Most people that come into the United States without documents really try to stay out of trouble and to keep their nose clean, because always once they if they did something, they were at risk of deportation. And now the U.S. has really increased the penalties in prison time for undocumented migrants who commit felonies in the United States. So,
Sam, where did you get that?
I'm one of the guys that works in the criminal justice system, and I've got firsthand knowledge of this sort of thing.
What do? You cop?
No, I'm a judge.
And so people come before you and say, I thought I was going to get away with this?
Now, the information I have from other sources in the criminal justice system is that there are certain areas of the country that are considered to be safe havens, which is why you have populations moving in there, because...
Where are these safe havens?
In the further north you go.
Rock Springs, Wyoming? Is Rock Springs, Wyoming one of them?
Yeah.
It is.
Southwest Wyoming. And Utah and that sort of thing. And the problem you have is that INS is concerned with the post 9/11 situation and may well have dropped its emphasis on that sort of thing.
Hmm.
Well, I would think that if you're looking for a safe haven, you'd go to East LA, because you're not going to stand out there. If you go up to southeastern Wyoming, you're going to stand out as a Mexican immigrant who doesn't speak English, who dresses differently, who doesn't know the way around. So, I find that kind of hard to believe.
Well, I live here, partner. You don't, and I kind of know what the situation is. I just wanted to share that with you, Neil.
Oh, well, thanks for the call, Sam. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Mario Villarreal joins us now, a spokesman for the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection. He's with us by phone from his office here in Washington, and thanks very much.
Good afternoon.
First of all, let's get the name straight. Your bureau used to be called the INS, or the Immigration and Naturalization Service?
That is correct.
And now it's all part of the Homeland Security Department?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, I am with the Border Patrol, but we came over to the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection.
Okay, we'll get them straight fairly soon. How have tasks changed since the reorganization of the Department of Homeland Security?
It's been quite smooth. The transition from us under INS, and I believe it was Sam from Rock Springs mentioned about INS, and the current INS, there is no longer an INS. The entities that were part of the Immigration Service has now been broken up. We, as the Border Patrol, came over intact under the leadership and guidance of Commissioner Bonner, and the transition has been quite smooth.
Well, I think Sam could be forgiven for being a little bit out of date because all of this happened quite recently.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, what patterns of migration are you seeing on the borders?
And I'd like to comment on all the speakers and the guests that you've had. They're quite knowledgeable, starting with John at the top of the hour.
Mm-hmm.
The historical process of migration and the migration phenomenon has been around for many, many years. Over 97% of the people that we arrest are from the country of Mexico. We understand that it's driven, the economic need is, by the migrant is to try to earn some money here in the United States. It's economic need, but they also understand that of the risks that they may encounter, and we are trying to work closely with the government of Mexico in developing public service announcements to try to get the word out about the dangers they may encounter.
Mm-hmm. And obviously they are more serious in the summertime, which is rapidly approaching.
Absolutely, and I just spent 3.5 days in Tucson, Arizona, and John mentioned Douglas in Naco, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
We are entering the hot season, hot time of the year, and this is definitely a tragedy, and our hearts and prayers go out to the families of the people that have lost their lives. But one of the things that we've mentioned, and it's been hit upon a couple of times, is the smuggler, the coyote. This is an individual that is definitely the criminal and has to be held responsible for the actions of what transpires in these tragedies.
Now, we should also make it clear that your agency does not make policy. You carry it out.
Absolutely. We enforce it. We patrol between the ports of entry. We have gone to great lengths in working with the government of Mexico in developing announcements and messages to warn would-be crossers of the dangers they may encounter. And it's kind of a threefold process in that you have to send the message to the interior before they leave their home and leave their families.
You mean the interior of Mexico?
Correct. And also you have to warn the migrants along the border corridor that have reached the border but have not yet crossed. And also, and lastly, you have to let the message know or send the message to the people that are here in the United States that are sponsoring their friends and family. Because what has transpired is it has become extremely difficult to cross the border illegally. Smuggling now rivals drug smuggling in that the prices, and it's been hit upon. The smuggling of people now rivals drug smuggling, that it's between $1,000 to $2,000 per person to be smuggled into the United States.
We're speaking with Douglas Massey of the Mexican Migration Project in Philadelphia and Maria Villarreal of the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection here in Washington. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener involved. Greg joins us on the line from San Diego.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on today. Neil, I'm a former immigration inspector at the San Ysidro Ports of Entry in San Diego. And literally daily, there are thousands of Mexican green card holders crossing the border. They live in Mexico. They come over to work each day. That's what they can afford to do. The law states that all resident aliens are required to reside in the United States, and that's one of the laws that's not enforced. For the most part, those people come over, they have entry-level jobs. There is no oversight or enforcement of the I-9 requirements to ensure that anybody that's employed in San Diego and other border states are legally authorized to do so. So that's attractive for the illegals that come over. They know that they can get jobs, and they make money and sit at home. They're not a threat for the most part. Unfortunately, when I was working the border, those that were, the emphasis was on stopping the Mexicans from crossing over, when in fact there should have been oversight on those Middle Easterners that were coming over and overstaying on those visas.
Mm-hmm.
But here again, it's attractive. They have the entry-level jobs here, and it's just, you know, there are migrant camps set up throughout the city. You can see them daily. In fact, I'm looking at a bunch of probably illegals right now, and people come by, they pick them up, they take them off to perform various jobs, and they're paid. And so that's what's attractive, and that's what keeps people from coming over, that's what keeps the Mexicans from coming across the border, because they know they can be employed and mm-hmm. get money back home to their families.
Mario Villarreal, would you get a response to that?
Very good point. And as I mentioned, the majority of the people that are attempting to cross illegally into the United States are primarily economic migrants, trying to get to the United States to make more money. The aspect of I-9 inspection and interior enforcement or worksite enforcement, our primary mission as of the Border Patrol is to protect our nation's borders between the ports of entry. So not only are we trying to detect and deter people entering the United States, but also terrorists and terrorist weapons, identifying those between the ports. There are a lot of people that are looking for a job, and to make a statement saying that there's a group of people on a street corner that they look like illegal, I would say that's not a true statement.
Well, are you being overwhelmed?
You know, apprehensions have consistently reduced, have been reduced the last couple of years. As at the top of the hour, you mentioned that we make about 1 million arrests each year. That has declined. I'll give you some statistics. In 2000, we arrested 1.6 million people. In 2001, we arrested 1.2 million people. And last year, fiscal year 2002, we arrested 955,000. It has become quite difficult to make illegal entry. We have more agents than we've ever had in our history. We have over 10,200. The new generation of technology, to include infrared cameras, state-of-the-art helicopters, it's much more difficult.
Greg, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
When we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation with Mario Villarreal and Douglas Massey on illegal immigration. We'll also talk about the U.S. decision, surprising to many, to sign on to the International Tobacco Treaty, and your letters. That's also coming up. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tomorrow, teens and sex on Talk of the Nation. We'll talk about the most effective ways to talk to your children about this sensitive and often undiscussed topic. We'll also have the latest statistics. Plus, Buffy's Last Stand. Marty Noxon joins us ahead of the last episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She's the executive producer of the program. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're discussing illegal immigration and border controls. Our guests are Douglas Massey, professor of sociology, director of the Mexican Migration Project at the University of Pennsylvania, and Mario Villarreal, spokesman for the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. And let's go right back to the phones. John joins us from East Hampton in New York.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I guess I wanted to, you have a guest on who's saying there are no safe havens, and I would disagree with him. I think once you're over the border, the whole country is a safe haven. As an example, I would say the crew that I work with in construction is probably made up of around 80% Hispanic people. Of those, a third to a half are openly illegal.
When you say openly illegal, what do you mean?
They will tell you if you ask them
In
a conversation. There are there was recently a front page article in one of the local papers about how hard it is for Hispanics to get assistance at government-funded or that there was not enough government-assisted programs to fund them. There are charities that openly advertise for funds to help them. If you want to close the borders, you've got to make it tough for people to be in the country, not just make it tough crossing the border. I think we have a dual policy.
Douglas Massey, I wonder if we could get a response on that.
Well, I think he's absolutely right, and also the prior caller is absolutely right. We've got a policy where we put all of our eggs in the basket of border enforcement, and we do nothing internally, so that we raise this incredible gauntlet trying to prevent people from getting into the United States, but then basically we say, well, once you're in, you're home free. So I agree that the entire country is, in this sense, a safe haven, but I would disagree with the other caller who said that, you know, some regions are safer than others.
Mm-hmm.
We really have virtually no internal enforcement, and that's a policy decision that has been made in Washington.
Mario Villarreal, you don't make that policy. Do you enforce it? I'm sorry, we must have lost Mario Villarreal.
There.
Oh, yes, there he is. Okay, we were having a technical problem. Please excuse us. Get a response from you on that?
Yeah, I think that we need everybody's help. If someone has identified a group of people or an individual that is here in the United States illegally, that they should call the local immigration office.
Well, there used to be programs where, the crackdown on employers who had illegal immigrants working for them, that a lot of the burden of this was put on employers.
That is correct, and that goes back to the previous caller with the I-9 form.
Uh-huh. And
he mentioned the locations that are safe haven throughout the United States, and
mm-hmm.
I have to emphasize that we need everybody's help here in the United States to please, if they've identified any type of suspicious activity, to not to hesitate to call local law enforcement or the local immigration office.
John, do you think that's your job? I guess John has left us. Well, anyway, we thank him for his call. Here's an email we got from Matt Teff in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. I've recently read about armed vigilante groups on the American-Mexican border. I'm wondering if these groups have been more or less helpful in dealing with Mexican-American border problems, and what's the federal government doing to make sure these groups don't get out of hand? Mario?
There are many groups along the southwest border. This individual is probably focusing on an area in Tucson. What I would say is that we appreciate the community's help, and if they see or hear any suspicious activity, to please call the Border Patrol, but also not to take matters into their own hands. And these groups have to work within the parameters of the law.
Are vigilante groups active?
There are groups. There are many groups along the southwest border that either are putting up water stations or passing out leaflets. So there are many groups along the southwest border that are assisting migrants.
Assisting migrants, not vigilante groups. My reading of that would be to try to collect them themselves privately and then force them back across the border.
This is definitely discouraged, and if anybody sees this happening, definitely notify law enforcement.
So, but you're unaware of that?
There are groups. There are groups along the southwest border that have been in place. They are very vocal. They try to get as much media attention as possible, and some of their antics are very vocal. But as far as the actual being aggressive against a migrant or migrants, this is definitely something that has to be brought up to local law enforcement because it is against the law.
Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Mario Villarreal, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mario Villarreal is a spokesman for the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection here in Washington, D.C. Douglas Massey, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Douglas Massey, professor of sociology and director of the Mexican Migration Project at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was with us from his office in Philadelphia.